This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In 2020, in the presidential campaign, Joe Biden managed to unify the Democrats behind him as a reassuring figure in the center of the party. And at the very same time, he put forward one of the most progressive and transformational agendas ever seen in modern Washington. And now, a year in, it's time to take stock of the successes and the failures of this administration. I'm going to turn things over now to staff writer Evan Osnos, who reports from Washington. Evan covered Joe Biden's campaign, and more recently, he profiled West Virginia's Joe Manchin, perhaps the second most powerful person in Washington right now. Here's Evan Osnos.
When Joe Biden came into office, it was a moment of extraordinary turmoil. It was just 2 weeks since the violence of January 6th. And under those circumstances, just a return to normalcy would have been challenging. But he had all along been promising something more. I covered his campaign, and over the course of it, Biden began to talk in larger and larger terms about what was possible, the sense that the only way to push back Trumpism was for Democrats to go big economically and politically. There was something incredibly ambitious about that vision, and I think to some it seemed impossible. To others, it was an inspiration, but he has really been wrestling with that ever since. I called up my colleague, also a Washington correspondent, Susan Glasser. Susan, President Biden didn't quite set out to be FDR, but he hung a portrait of FDR on the wall of the Oval Office, and he clearly invited the comparison. Looking at that now, it feels like a very long time ago. And I wonder what you make of those ambitions that he had as you look at it now.
Well, you know, I guess, right, there's many different FDRs, and I think there's the FDR as crisis president, which is almost certainly what Biden meant to channel by hanging that up. Then there is the sort of FDR, LBJ as sort of architects of a new American progressive order. And I think that it was the morphing of aspiration that we saw in the first spring of the Biden presidency that did take me, and I think others, to a certain extent by surprise, given the obvious gap between the political abilities of Biden to enact anything like a transformative progressive agenda. But I think, again, he came into office as a crisis president. And remember that, you know, the model that a lot of people had in mind back in the 2020 election campaign really was Trump as this sort of evil reincarnation of Herbert Hoover, right? You know, mm-hmm. that he was the guy who plunged American society into chaos and seemed completely unable to master the crisis or to give Americans a view for a way out of it.
In some ways, Biden talked elliptically about crisis for a long time. And then he gave a speech on the anniversary of the January 6th Capitol attack. And you wrote, and I'm reading here, that it was a powerful speech, an angry speech, a necessary speech. It was also a speech that Biden wanted very much not to deliver. Why is that?
Well, That still is actually one of the mysteries to me, although I think I understand it. Here in Washington, there is a conventional wisdom among some Democrats that basically Donald Trump is kind of remains a third rail of politics for Democrats in terms of their public messaging, that Democrats won elections in 2018 in the midterms, not by talking about Donald Trump, but by talking about things like healthcare and what they were going to get done for middle-class voters. And one has to assume that Biden subscribed to that to a certain extent, at least the political analysis, because he spent so much of his first year in office not talking about Donald Trump, who assumed this sort of Voldemort-like quality of being he who shall not be named. And interestingly enough, Biden finally comes out and gives this full-throated January 6th speech. 16 times he refers in that speech to the former president, never once does utter his name, although the words are crystal clear and very scathing. But basically, Biden and his White House, their strategy seemed to be to put him above the fray and to let the Democrats on Capitol Hill be sort of the ones wielding axes and hatchets and subpoenas, if you will.
So do you think, was he wrong, really, to wait as long as he did to come out swinging against Trumpism? Was that instinct, in a sense, misplaced, do you think?
Well, what we can certainly say in this early date of the Biden presidency is that it didn't help him at a time when he desperately needed political help. And what is so striking, and certainly we don't know how this ends, but people will look at Biden's first year and, you know, the line is pretty unmistakable. You had him coming in, all things considered, actually at quite a high level of popularity, you know, around 60% of Americans approving, certainly a collective sigh of relief, even from a decent-sized chunk of Republicans who bought into, as many Democrats did, Biden's promise of normalcy and return to a kind of sense of competence, governance, status quo anti-ism, if you will. And then, boom, by the middle of 2021, Biden's numbers started going down, and that's when Independence Day from COVID-19 did not happen as he had promised it would, and even held a party on the White House lawn for July 4th. And it started down then, and it never really went back up. And look, it's not Donald Trump's fault anymore that we weren't prepared for this Omicron wave. It's not Donald Trump's fault that the testing infrastructure in the United States was not ready, that we didn't have an easy way to reopen things. Biden imposed mandates that might have blocked both the Delta wave and the Omicron wave far too late after the politics of it had solidified in a very, very debilitating way.
You know, it obviously doesn't all happen in a vacuum. And, you know, what has been going on off stage, in effect, has been this very sustained effort by conservative broadcasting, in many cases by the former president's allies and the former president himself, to kind of muddy up the process. Was there something that the Biden administration, do you think, could have done that might have short-circuited that strategy, which has turned out to gum things up so dramatically?
Look, I mean, you've written about that, and so have I. I do believe it's very important to say that Republicans made a self-fulfilling prophecy out of vaccine denialism and refusal to take public health measures. And that has clearly influenced the political trajectory of the Biden presidency so far. I mean, there's just that seems absolute and unequivocal. I also think that they have been remarkably successful, Biden's opponents, and this kind of right infrastructure at shaping the terms at every step along the way of the debate and the discourse. And it's the fear of further stirring up this hornet's nest that seems to have shaped a lot of the Biden decision-making around the virus and the pandemic, for example, on mandates. Why is it today that we don't have a mandate for airline travel that you have to be vaccinated, as basically all other comparable countries have? We are literally allowing people to fly around the country right now who are unvaccinated and spread the virus. If you were serious about stopping the pandemic and believing that that was the foundation of success for your administration, for this country, not to mention your political standing, that is a clear-cut measure that you would not only take now, but would have taken many, many, many months ago. And many more people would not have died as a result of it.
You can't talk about politics today, Susan, without talking about Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. He comes up constantly on every issue, it feels like, and he's obviously a major point of frustration for this president and for Democrats. Strategically, it's been impossible to move him. But what options do you think there are now for Biden when it comes to appealing to the public, appealing to Manchin's particular needs, his political reality? How do you think he moves forward with something like the Build Back Better bill in the coming months?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting. I think we're now in a situation which I think has some echoes with the Washington past, where Manchin won't even take the deal that he himself offered a couple months ago. And, you know, this I was just saying the other day, this reminds me very much, actually, of the failed Clinton health care plan back in the 1990s. Remember, that was the very first thing that Bill Clinton wanted to do. He very controversially assigned his wife, Hillary Clinton, the first lady, to oversee task force. There were huge negotiations. Everybody started out expecting that, well, of course, some bill would be passed, even if it wasn't everything. And Bob Dole did something that is basically what Joe Manchin is doing. He negotiated and negotiated and negotiated, put down various offers, which had Clinton seized that offer, said yes to it, even though it wasn't everything he wanted, he would have passed a bill. By the time months later, when Bill Clinton got around to trying to accept Bob Dole's deal, it was no longer on offer. And Bob Dole himself would not accept the deal. And to me, that's where we are with Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin won't even accept the deal, the $1.8 trillion Build Back Better deal that he himself offered 6 weeks ago. So I'm very skeptical, or at least doubtful at the moment, that Biden has a path forward there. The other thing I would say is that the Manchin thing in some ways has sort of, I think, contributed to the downgrading and demeaning of the Biden presidency by making Biden seem once again as just another senator. And he's just negotiating, you know, with this single senator. It really, I think it's shown that one guy can gum up the works and kind of diminish the power of the office. It's been surprising to me that Democrats have focused so much, except that they're Democrats, so it's not surprising, but they focus so much on attacking the one senator of their own. But in a 50-50 Senate, what they haven't talked about is the united wall of Republican opposition. That's the reason that this bill isn't passing, is Republicans. It's not one Democrat. It's 50 Republicans.
After the Build Back Better bill stalled, Biden turned to voting rights. That became the new focus. And in a bid to get that passed, he endorsed changing the filibuster rules this week, which is something that, as a former senator, he had always resisted.
Barack Obama had endorsed a change even back in the 2020 campaign. That was one of the things that he did. But Biden held back until now. And I think the frustration, the very real prospect of losing both the House and Senate, all of those things have spurred and given new energy to a last-minute push by Democrats on voting rights. But here, too, I think it's very similar to the Build Back Better. You basically have this political question for Democrats, which is, do you want to push forward measures that are very popular potentially with your voters but are impossible in the gridlock situation you face in the Congress today? Or do you want to find out, you know, here are the things that we actually can get done? And, you know, Biden, by inclination, is the latter. But in terms of where the politics of today is, It's all about the former in both parties. And that is a big reason why it took so long to get something like the infrastructure bill done. And I have to say, a year ago, before the horror of January 6th, the thing that happened that morning was that Democrats won control of the Senate that they were not expected to win because Donald Trump had turned off all the Republicans in Georgia by saying, essentially, your votes won't be counted, you can't be trusted. And he basically handed control of the Senate to Democrats. What have they done with it?
I think this is what mystifies people so much about Joe Manchin, frankly, is that here is a bill that would literally provide child tax credits for tens of thousands of children in one of the poorest states in the country, and yet he has objected to it. And yet he has said, no, I'm not going to do it.
Well, why not bring up a vote then, Evan, on child tax credits? Why not bring up a vote on all of these individual things? I mean, it's not just Joe Manchin, but plenty of people, including me, by the way, who says, I don't know what's in this bill. I don't know what's in this bill. So you're just going to spend billions of generic dollars. Nobody understands what it is, and we're going to wrap everything into one piece of legislation. Why not take the politically popular aspects of it, where you could get some Republican votes as well, by the way, on many of the provisions of this? That was an alternate course available.
So the perfect is the enemy of the good in this case.
And always.
Susan Glasser, thank you very much.
Thank you, Evan.
That's The New Yorker's Susan Glasser, who writes the column Letter from Biden's Washington. And I'm Evan Osnos, a staff writer. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. We'll continue looking at year one of the Biden administration in just a moment. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We've been talking about the Biden administration in its first year and all the challenges that lie ahead. Steering us through this is Evan Osnos, who's a Washington correspondent for the New Yorker and is the author of Wildland, The Making of America's Fury, which came out in the fall.
Biden has faced a huge array of challenges left by his predecessor. No area has been more vexed for him than immigration. The Trump administration was laser-focused on changing policies around asylum and immigration quotas, changing them in ways that would not be easy to undo, not to mention the long shadow of family separations at the border. Hey, Jonathan Blitzer.
Evan, how are you?
Good to see you.
Likewise.
My colleague Jonathan Blitzer followed immigration policy throughout the Trump administration and into Biden's. What were the key promises that they made as a campaign? And where do they stand on those now?
The biggest promises the Biden administration made coming into office had to do with asylum at the border. That was sort of both literally and symbolically some of the ugliest stuff that the Trump administration had done over the last 4 years. And so, for one thing, the Biden administration said it was going to reverse a policy called the Migrant Protection Protocols, a sort of Orwellian term that basically described a policy that turned 60,000 asylum seekers away and forced them to wait in Mexico while their asylum claims were processed by backlogged American immigration courts. And of course, to wait in Mexico indefinitely is an extremely dangerous proposition. Before the music stopped, before the courts blocked the administration from going any further, the White House successfully managed to parole in about 13,000 people. That's no small feat under the circumstances. But when you look at the number of people who in theory were eligible to be brought in, you're looking at a population of some 60,000 people. The other giant policy that really matters is a policy called Title 42, which basically the Trump administration kind of contrived during the pandemic to justify expelling en masse anyone who showed up at the southern border seeking asylum on the grounds that they posed a public health risk.
A COVID risk, in effect.
You know, a pandemic-related risk. Now, what's become clear in the months and now years since that order was first put in place was that a number of scientists at places like the CDC and elsewhere have said that there's no actual scientific benefit or public health rationale for keeping this policy in place. But the Biden administration has clung to it mostly because they're scared to lose this tool that allows them to basically expel anyone who shows up at the border without giving them any kind of hearing. And so it's a very seductive policy and kind of a tragically seductive policy for the Biden administration, because it's not really a process. As one administration official described it to me, it's a non-process process. It gives the administration the illusion of being able to clear the border and sort of seemingly take the border out of the news by expelling people en masse. But what's happening as a result is they're not building up a policy to begin to deal with these numbers. Instead, they're just expelling anyone who shows up.
Jonathan, how much of Trump's policy is expected to stay in place for the foreseeable future? And what really can't be unwound?
It's overwhelming to me, the lasting impact of what Trump has done. And what's interesting to me covering this is that I know inside the administration there are people who had a clear understanding of how hard it was going to be to unwind some of these things. There was a plan that was laid out, a provisional plan, as these things are, during the transition. And what we've seen happen is a high turnover of people who are expert in immigration policy, who are now no longer in the administration. They started with a sense of high purpose. They kind of got burned out. They got frustrated. They're gone. And so the people really driving very complex immigration policy at the border are high-level political advisors to the president who look at these issues not from a lens of what's best operationally or from a policy perspective, but who are preoccupied with the political impact of all of this on the president. And so, you know, we're talking about Ron Klain, Biden's chief of staff. We're talking about Susan Rice at the Domestic Policy Council. We're talking about Jake Sullivan at the National Security Council. These are leaders whose portfolios don't typically include kind of granular operational details involving border policy. But because they've judged this issue to be so politically dangerous to Biden, they're kind of calling the shots. And a lot of the plans that had been laid out that would have allowed us to see that the administration was sort of marking out incremental goals, those plans have been frozen. And now it's a little bit of just kind of catch as catch can responding to crises as they emerge at the border, which is honestly surprising this late into the administration.
One area Biden hoped to go big, and within which he has a very narrow window to act, is climate change. There were some climate provisions in the infrastructure bill, which Congress passed in November, but the vast majority of the big proposals were folded into the Build Back Better legislation, which has stalled. Elizabeth Colbert is my colleague here at The New Yorker and has written extensively about climate. Broadly speaking, Betsy, how did Joe Biden hope to tackle climate change when he came into office?
Well, it's a several front battle, I guess, if we can use that word. So there are regulatory means. Mm-hmm. There are procurement. The administration has gone pretty big on, you know, let's use the power of the federal government's spending. The federal government just buys a lot of stuff. Let's try to use that to push as a push mechanism for clean energy, for electric vehicles. And then, of course, there was legislation. And as you alluded to, on the legislative front, we've gotten bollocksed up.
Hmm. How would you, if you had to, give a grade to the administration's performance so far?
Well, I think that's tough. I mean, you know, they have put in place new car standards, so vehicle miles, which translates very directly into emissions. So I think they deserve credit for that. The process, you know, Jonathan alluded to in the previous segment, how hard it is to unroll some of these things that the Trump administration did. I think that they are also coming up against that. Rulemaking is laborious. It's unmaking rules is laborious. Mm. It's time consuming. You want it to hold up in court. Everything will be litigated. And I think that also hangs over everything the administration does. Now, you know, you've got to close a lot of fossil fuel plants. We certainly shouldn't be, you know, pursuing any more fossil fuel projects. And I think that is where the Biden administration is sort of justifiably getting pushback at this point. They are still, you know, handing out a lot of oil leases and things like that. Now, they would argue, well, you know, once again, we can't just turn on a dime. They did have a court case. They were trying to stop some of these leases or slow them down. And they had a court case, which they lost to a Trump appointee in a federal court. So, you know, they do have their hands tied in a bunch of ways, unfortunately. But you know, step one for not making problems worse is, you know, stop digging the hole. And we haven't even done that yet, unfortunately.
Betsy, it won't shock you to hear that the name Joe Manchin has already come up in these conversations today, and he's a big force when it comes to climate change legislation, or more specifically, impeding climate change legislation. He is obviously somebody who comes out of a state that mines a lot of coal. He has made part of his fortune from the coal industry. And yet there was this interesting moment when he proposed his alternative bill to the Build Back Better legislation. There was something in there that might have addressed some concerns about climate. How do you think about the possibility, if there is any, of getting Joe Manchin on board for climate change legislation?
Well, there was a really interesting development just recently, you know, where the coal miners in West Virginia came out in favor of, you know, some of the provisions of Build Back Better, because there's money in there for transitioning, you know, mine workers into new, you know, new jobs, new industries. And I think that now you have this interesting situation where you have the mine owners versus the mine workers. And which side is Joe Manchin going to come down on? You know, not a happy thought to think that, you know, he would even sell out the miners in favor of the mine owners. But anything, unfortunately, seems possible right now.
President Biden's fortunes are tied, as nearly all presidents are, to what happens in the economy, what happens with jobs, inflation, and the emotional sense that people have about whether things are getting better or getting worse. And because of the pandemic, this administration has really been in uncharted territory since day one. John Cassidy covers the economy and politics for The New Yorker. Part of the puzzle of the economy today is that there's actually a fair amount of good news right now. Unemployment claims are low, wages are rising. The stock market has been hitting new highs, the kind of highs that Donald Trump would have, of course, crowed about if he was still president. And yet Americans are feeling pessimistic. I mean, the measures of the mood are quite clear. Why is that? How do you think that affects politics? And why do you get this combination of factors that produces overall this sense of kind of meh?
malaise or whatever.
Right.
Jimmy Carter's word. That was the famous word from the 70s, which people are starting to dredge up again.
And the word I would say that the Biden administration is desperate to sort of run away from, but of course it is the word that are on.
Well, I'm on the other side of the debate here. I think the narrative about the economy is far too negative at the moment. I mean, let's go through a few of them. If you look at jobs, 6.4 million jobs created last year, that's a calendar year record. The unemployment rate down to 3.9%. We did get down to those rates pre-pandemic, but if you look at it over the last 20 or 30 years, that's a very low rate of unemployment, 3.9%. Child poverty rate has fallen by 30% in the last year, largely because of the stimulus package, which had the child income tax credits, sending people checks. Wages, they're not rising quite as high as inflation overall. We're talking 5 or 6% wage gains. That's strong growth. Obviously, it's been eaten into by inflation. So you'd say overall real wages are about level or down a bit. But in certain sectors of the economy, which we should be more concerned about, low wage industries especially, we've had huge wage gains over the last year, 10, 15%. If you look at leisure and hospitality, people have had a $2 an hour roughly raise over last year, which, you know, they were only earning $14, $15 an hour. That's very material. Mm-hmm. So you put all those on one side of the ledger, and it's a long list. And then you put inflation on the other side of the ledger. It seems to me that the narrative, you know, is skewed here.
The Biden administration would probably say, well, they would put some of this at the feet of our business. They'd say that you reporters are all stuck in this kind of negative mode. And then there is the question of style and of whether or not the administration has figured out how to capture people's attention, force them in effect to acknowledge the good news. Is there something along the way? Are there moments that you look to and say, this was a missed opportunity? This was a moment when they could have said to people, the numbers are indisputable. You have to acknowledge the progress that's been made on the economy, and they didn't do it.
I think they could have done more. They did talk about early on. If you remember, after they passed the stimulus package back mm-hmm. in March, there were stories out of the White House that they were going to send the president on the road to promote it. They were going to send the vice president and other cabinet members out on the road to promote what they were doing. And I think they did for a week or two, but then it just stopped. Hmm. You know, there wasn't a sort of sustained media campaign over the entire year to sort of promote the, as far as I know anyway, to promote the various aspects of the bill and how it's been working.
And yet it does feel as if one of the things you're identifying is that they have been unable to figure out a way to force people to pay attention. Is that specific, do you think, to this administration? Or is that
Well, I think, you know, I mean, you know, I've been critical here, but I want to, you know, say something in the White House's defense here. The pandemic overrides everything. Mm. I mean, it really, you know, it's very hard for me to see how, given the course of the pandemic over last year, the White House could have somehow changed the story to their domestic policy successes. Because if you look at the job figures, just to get back to what we were talking about earlier, there's still a shortfall of about 4 or 5 million jobs from the pre-pandemic levels. And it's overwhelmingly concentrated in those sectors which were hardest hit by the pandemic, like restaurants, leisure, theme parks, things like that. You know, the rest of the economy, just in sheer quantitative terms, you know, has largely recovered.
And do you think that will lift Biden's fortunes a bit?
But yeah, I mean, you know, it's a game of four innings, right? We've only had one. So, you know, we're only at the end of the first year. Lots of presidents have been very unpopular at the end of the first year. I mean, I think it's ridiculous to write off Biden. Mm. Who knows what will happen? Now, for the midterms, obviously, it's looking shaky for the Democrats. But for 2024, I think it's way too early to come to any conclusions whatsoever. You know, it's 3 years away. It's a world. They used to say in England that a week's a long time in politics. Well, if a week's a long time, 3 years is an eternity.
The New Yorker's Evan Osnos speaking with John Cassidy. And we heard before him from Elizabeth Colbert and John Blitzer, all of them staff writers for The New Yorker. And you can find all of their work on newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
I'm not very analytical. I just tend to think if something's out there, then I've got to show it to somebody else.
That's the late Joan Didion speaking on WNYC in 1987.
I'm very, very bothered all the time by people not seeing what's out there, not wanting to see things that are perfectly obvious.
Joan Didion had a long and evolving career. From her early novels through the extraordinary essays about American life in the 60s and the 70s, the political reporting of the 80s and 90s, and then the memoirs of personal loss in the 2000s. Didion died when she was 87, just before the holidays. And in the weeks since, there's been an outpouring of acclaim that shows something quite clearly. Joan Didion's reputation continued to grow over the decades, where some of her contemporaries seem now like voices of another time. Didion still speaks to several generations of writers and readers.
I like words. I mean, I like making, I'm very excited by seeing what can be done with words.
So why is Joan Didion's work aged so well? In The New Yorker, we published a number of postscripts on Didion, and I'm going to talk with two of our contributors. The critic Hilton Alves will join us in a second, but first, here's Emma Klein.
Emma, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Klein has written fiction and essays for The New Yorker, and her novel, The Girls, from 2016, is about a young girl drawn into a cult in 1960s California, what we might think of as Joan Didion country. You've chosen a passage from Joan Didion to read. Can you set this passage up for us?
Yeah, so this is from her essay called Why I Write, that she delivered when she was a lecturer at Berkeley when she was 40. And she had attended Berkeley as an undergraduate. During the years when I was an undergraduate at Berkeley, I tried, with a kind of hopeless late adolescent energy, to buy some temporary visa into the world of ideas, to forge for myself a mind that could deal with the abstract. In short, I tried to think. I failed. My attention veered inexorably back to the specific, to the tangible, to what was generally considered by everyone I knew then, and for that matter have known since, the peripheral. I would try to contemplate the Hegelian dialectic and would find myself concentrating instead on a flowering pear tree outside my window and the particular way the petals fell on my floor. I would try to read linguistic theory and would find myself wondering instead if the lights were on in the Bevatron up the hill. When I say that I was wondering if the lights were on in the Bevatron, you might immediately suspect, if you deal in ideas at all, that I was registering the Bevatron as a political symbol, thinking in shorthand about the military-industrial complex and its role in the university community. But you would be wrong. I was only wondering if the lights were on in the Bevatron and how they looked. A physical fact. I can no longer tell you whether Milton put the sun or the earth at the center of his universe in Paradise Lost, the central question of at least one century, and a topic about which I wrote 10,000 words that summer, but I can still recall the exact rancidity of the butter in the city of San Francisco's dining car, and the way the tinted windows on the Greyhound bus cast the oil refineries around Carquinez Straits into a grayed and obscurely sinister light. In short, my attention was always on the periphery, on what I could see and taste and touch, on the butter and the Greyhound bus.
Emma, tell me a little bit about your first encounter with Joan Didion's work. What did you read how did it strike you? You're from a similar part of the country.
Yes. I think I must have first come across her in high school, reading one of her essays for a class. And yeah, I think so much of what I was drawn to at first was somebody writing about the landscape where I was from, and kind of honoring that landscape in the same way that I saw other landscapes honored and talked about. Yeah, and the specificity of those images and the sort of regional specificity really spoke to me.
If there's a single work in that really sticks with you, that had the biggest mark on you as a human being and as a writer, what is it?
I really love her fiction, but the nonfiction to me is what's always sort of stuck with me, like Slouching Towards Bethlehem, the essays in that book, and the White Album. I think both of those really are the ones I return to again and again.
She famously said that she writes to find out what she thinks and not to make an argument that's conceived ahead of time. Can you talk about her influence in writing journalism that seeks as opposed to argues? Has that had a real mark on you?
Yeah, definitely. I think for me, when she talks about, you know, she writes, you don't write it, it writes you. She's following these images that has what she calls like a shimmer in the mind, almost like this life force in you that seeks out these images with some intelligence beyond your conscious mind. And I think definitely for me, in both fiction and nonfiction, that way of thinking has allowed me to, you know, to be able to start off a project without knowing where it's going, and using the process of writing to kind of track the contours of my own thinking. I think her style, that approach has been massively influential, definitely to my generation. Her influence is so massive. I almost can't think of a writer who is more of a touchstone for every writer that I know.
You don't really work anything through just sitting around and thinking about it. You have to write it down.
Hilton Alls is a longtime staff writer and a winner of the Pulitzer Prize in Criticism. Hilton started with a passage from Joan Didion's novel, A Book of Common Prayer, published in 1977.
The reason I chose this selection is it says a great deal about her life as a reporter and a fiction writer. It is the story of a woman told by another woman who is an anthropologist who gives up the field, and she wants to understand self-delusion, really, and how society makes dreamers. So I thought, rather than go to an essay that might be more familiar, I would show that her concerns were across the board in fiction and nonfiction. Here is what happened. She left one man, she left a second man, she traveled again with the first. She let him die alone. She lost one child to history and another to complications. I offer in each instance the evaluation of others. She imagined herself capable of shedding that baggage and came to Boca Grande, a tourist, una turista. So she said. In fact, she came here less a tourist than a sojourner, but she did not make that distinction. She made not enough distinctions. She dreamed her life. She died hopeful. In summary, so you know the story. Of course, the story had extenuating circumstances, weather, cracked sidewalks, and Paris arena, but only for the living.
Hilton, I wonder as a writer, if you had spent the evening reading that prose and that prose rhythm, that you could get it out of your ear to write like you. I mean, it's just such an indelible, inimitable, yes, incantation when you read it.
Yes. It's very interesting to fall under her spell. And one of the things that you have to do as a young writer is really unlearn her, because the voice is really so much a part of the story. You have to, in a way, it's a very important lesson to learn how to fight against her in order to find your own voice.
Do you ever think the voice fell into, I hate to say it, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but self-parody? Sometimes there seems to be, there's the amazing work, and then once in a while, you feel you're hearing, as with Hemingway, as with, I guess with any great writer, them doing themselves. Is that unfair?
I don't think that's unfair. I think that it happens to all of us, actually. at one point or another, you forget what you sound like.
Yeah.
I think that when writers fall into that trap, it's actually because they don't remember what they've done before, and they don't actually remember what they sound like. And it's almost as if they're starting afresh, and they're thinking, oh, what a wonderful new voice I've discovered.
And they're forcing it a little.
Yes.
Hilton, I know you knew Joan Didion, and you interviewed her. There was this spectacular interview that you did with her for the Paris Review. And yes, you're working on an exhibition inspired by her life and work. What was she like?
Well, one of the things that really has to be stressed is how funny she was, and also a person who loved to laugh. I was by no means one of her intimates, but one of the things that was very striking to me was her willingness to talk to young writers and to be interested in young writers and to support them in any way that she could. That also goes unremarked. Her incredible generosity toward younger writers and her willingness and ability to laugh. I think those things got kind of left out of the obituaries that I read, certainly.
Yeah, the public impression of her is of somebody of almost really solemn presentation.
Yes.
And you don't imagine her as the, you know, Chris Rock of her moment. But how do you mean funny?
Well, I think that, for instance, if she didn't like something, she wouldn't say, I don't like the thing. She would just say C minus or A plus if she liked it.
What do you make of her politics? Famously, she was noticed first not by some left-wing journal, but in fact by William F. Buckley noticed Joan Didion early on. And she comes from not the California of the left, but something else. She began as a Goldwater Republican.
Yes. I think that I'm fascinated by people who make those transitions from, or leaps from one set of beliefs to another. And I think that those beliefs really were her father's, her parents, and her family at that time. I don't think that she was really so much a Buckleyite as she was interested in writing. And I think that her experience at the National Review showed her that the politics weren't her politics after a while.
My being drawn to political issues is relatively recent, actually. I don't know what caused it, but one morning I just started reading the paper in a different way.
Hilton, you wrote in your appreciation of Didion this, no country but America.
Thank you for making me do it.
That's what I'm here for.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. Hilton, you wrote, no country but America could have produced Joan Didion, and no other country would have tolerated her. What made her unique to our country and how Americans relate to the world?
Well, I think that, first of all, we're able to have a political language that's much more complicated and way less ideological than most other places in the world. And I think that another underestimated aspect of her writing was her political analysis. And so if you're going to be an analytical, verbal woman, I don't know that many cultures that really would tolerate that. Do you?
Well, let's hope that it continues to tolerate it.
Yes, exactly.
In the 80s and 90s, Didion turned to world events and political affairs in works like Salvador and After Henry, where she writes about, of course, a famous essay on the Central Park jogger and the kids who were put in jail as outraged children. Why do you suppose this work is regarded or at least read a little bit less than, say, The White Album and Slouching Toward Bethlehem?
Well, I think that is a very good question, David. And it has a lot to do with something that I mentioned that's very sort of touchy aspect about the image of or nostalgia for white female fragility. And we talked about that a little bit in the essay that I wrote for you. And it has a lot to do with the drama of fragility and the privilege of fragility. And I think that, again, after Goldwater, after the National Review, and then after becoming a persona in the essays, she realized that, as she said, she didn't want to be Miss Lonely Hearts. And I think that the later political reporting and analysis are less read because she doesn't give an inch to the reader in terms of a familiar presence, the familiar presence of that white female fragile persona that did become a persona after a while. And I'm glad that she jettisoned it as a thinker and as a writer, because it was limiting after a while.
There's a documentary about her made by her nephew Griffin Dunn from a few years ago. And for me, the most vivid moment is when she fesses up to what all reporters feel at some time or another. She says she was hanging out with the Doors.
Oh, yes.
And she encountered in Haight-Ashbury a 6 or 7 year old kid.
In high kindergarten.
And the kid is high on acid.
Yeah. And she said, it's gold.
Exactly. In other words, not I'm reacting as, in a maternal
as
way.
As a person or as a woman or anything, right? It's writer's gold. And you're standing there. And I think that we talk about that in our obituary for her, was that you're not anything when you're standing there. And in order to write it down, you can't be David Remnick and I can't be Hilton Ells. David and Hilton have to go away. And the writer has to take over and see that it's gold for the piece.
And it's some kind of combination of predatory and professionalism.
Yes, and also kind of absence too, right? That we don't get to be ourselves now. We don't get to be the nurturing people everyone loves. We get to be writers.
Hilton, thanks so much, and thank you for the essay.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
You can find an essay by Hilton Ells on the late Joan Didion at newyorker.com, along with pieces by Emma Klein, Zadie Smith, and Nathan Heller. I'm David Remnick, and that's our show for today. Thanks for joining us.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.